Senator Ted Stevens takes the witness stand today to testify in his own behalf. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an examination of potential climate impacts from coal to liquid technology for Fairbanks.
Trying to look at ways to minimize the amount of CO2 that we're releasing into the atmosphere from that kind of a project.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center opening celebration is October 18th and 19th, featuring big, wild events. Beginning at 10 a.m., free activities for the whole family include live entertainment, an oxygen and octane expo, a street fair along F Street showcasing the new Anchorage Convention District, and Warren Miller Films at the Egan Center. Event information is available online at anchorage.net. This message is sponsored by the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau.
The campaigns for the two congressional seats on next month's ballot are drawing a lot of money for the candidates. And according to Federal Election Commission reports filed yesterday, they have plenty of that money left. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The two Democrats and two Republicans on the ballot in a couple of weeks have raised a total of $2.4 million just in the past 2 months. At the top of the fundraisers is Democratic candidate for the Senate Mark Begich, who brought in $1.3 million since August 7th. He's raised more than $3 million since beginning the race back in February. Incumbent Ted Stevens, however, has more money left over to spend between now and November 4th. Senator Stevens reported raising $490,000 since August, about 40% of the amount brought in by his opponent. However, he has $1.2 million cash on hand. The House race is much less expensive, with Democrat Ethan Berkowitz raising $520,000 in the past 2 months. Berkowitz reports having $384,000 on hand for the final weeks. And incumbent Don Young raised $131,000 to bring his cash on hand to $275,000. His income for the current period is only about a fourth of the amount Berkowitz has raised. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
An international team of scientists is out with a yearly assessment of climate change in the Arctic. As KUAC's Dan Bross tells us, the report shows widespread and in some cases dramatic effects of warming across the northernmost tier of the globe.
It's the third year in a row that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has released what it calls the Arctic Report Card. It focuses on physical and biological climate-driven changes on land and sea. Chief Editor Jackie Richter-Menge with the Cold Regions Research Lab in New Hampshire says decreasing sea ice remains the overriding indicator of a warming Arctic.
As has been widely reported, the 2008 summer sea ice extent was at a near record minimum, coming in a close second to the record just set last summer in 2007. In general, the Arctic Ocean continued to warm and freshen.
Richter-Menge says the report also shows an increasingly green Arctic landmass, decreasing snow cover and receding glaciers. She says the physical changes on land and sea are affecting wildlife across the region, including the Arctic's most prominent species.
Reduced sea ice has been implicated in lower body conditions and reduced survival of polar bears in western Hudson Bay.
Richter-Menge says record summer sea ice retreat has also forced walrus out of the water, increasing their mortality. She also described climate-driven reorganization of ecosystems in the Barents and Bering Seas, noting that some species are benefiting and that climate change is not one-dimensional.
As is the case with all good stories, there are certainly twists to this plot. There are inconsistencies in the signals throughout the Arctic system. For instance, unlike most of the Arctic that is experiencing a general warming, the Bering Sea is in a prolonged cold phase. While permafrost temperatures continue to warm, the rate of the warming since the turn of the century is significantly slower than in the 1990s.
University of Alaska Fairbanks permafrost expert Vladimir Romanovsky, another report author, described a mosaic of frozen and thawing ground in the Arctic. Romanovsky says not all permafrost is changing at the same rate.
Little Ice Age permafrost, which is only 200 to 400 years old, is actively thawing right now. and also a little bit older permafrost, just several thousand years old, started to thaw, also in Alaska and in Siberia. However, we still see that the older permafrost, which was formed during the last glacial period, about 20 to 40, 60,000 years ago, is still more or less stable.
The report researchers talk about feedback loops like ice and snow declines, which allow increased solar heat absorption. They describe a big picture that's multifaceted. It includes natural weather oscillations, sunspot, and volcanic activity. NOAA's James Overland says human greenhouse gas emissions overlaid on those drivers have put us in an unprecedented position.
Natural variability and an emerging global warming signal together were both necessary to put us in this strange new world of massive sea ice loss that it's going to be hard to go back from.
Overland says what's different about the current warming trend is its more widespread nature across the Arctic and the massive feedback loops set in motion that make it very hard to reverse, regardless of oscillating natural forces. The NOAA scientists emphasized the participation of 46 authors from 10 countries and the peer-reviewed nature of the Arctic report card. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A public forum at the University of Alaska Fairbanks last night focused on the local potential for coal-to-liquids technology. Fairbanks Mayor Jim Whitaker and Department of Energy Representative Brent Sheets participated in the discussion put on by the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, which recently completed a local greenhouse gas inventory. Center Director Gwen Holdman says emissions from a coal-to-liquids plant are a key issue.
Trying to look at ways to minimize the amount of CO2 that we're releasing into the atmosphere from that kind of a project. And so carbon sequestration that might be associated with a project like that, we're taking a look at, what our current emissions are and how those might be impacted by a future project.
Several Fairbanks entities and the U.S. Air Force are looking into construction of a multi-billion dollar plant that would convert local coal into liquid fuels for heating and transportation, including military planes at Eielson Air Force Base. Holdman says the Alaska Center for Energy and Power will host forums monthly on energy issues of interest. She says the Susitna Dam is next month's topic. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, tips for survival and aiding rescue.
So you can be out there in the pitch black, have nothing more than a cigarette, and we'll find you. I mean, it looks like somebody's shining a flashlight at us.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
APRN would like to thank BP for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
Senator Ted Stevens says he never engaged in a scheme to conceal anything from the Senate. Stevens took the stand today in his own defense. He's on trial in Washington for felony counts of lying on his financial disclosure forms. APRN's Libby Casey is covering the trial in Washington and joins us by phone. Hi, Libby.
Good evening, Lori.
Libby, Senator Stevens didn't have to take the stand. Did you know he would?
Well, his lawyers announced a few days ago that he would testify, but there was much questioning going on by court watchers and the press. It's really common for people not to take the stand when they're on trial because it's seen as being risky. You know, you open yourself up to cross-examination. So we didn't really know what was going to happen until this afternoon when it was time to call the next witness. The defense called Senator Stevens.
In this trial, most of the testimony has started with softer questions, people talking about their background. Did Stevens get right to the point?
Yes. In a rapid fire, his attorney, Brendan Sullivan, asked him, "When you signed the forms, did you believe they were accurate and truthful?" And Stevens said, "Yes, sir." Sullivan asked, "Did you ever intentionally file false statements?" Stevens said, "No, I did not." And Sullivan asked, "And did you engage in any scheme to conceal anything from the Senate?" Stevens said, "No, sir." Stevens was only on the stand for about 20 minutes before the court day ended.
So, Libby, will Senator Stevens return to the stand tomorrow?
Absolutely. Tomorrow will be the big day when they'll have to get into the meat of the case. Did Stevens know about gifts given to him by oilfield services company Vigo and its CEO Bill Allen, as well as gifts from other friends? We've heard a lot of testimony in the last 4 weeks about the gifts. You know, we've seen emails about them. Some of the gifts are still sitting at Stevens' homes in Alaska and Washington. So now it's Ted Stevens' turn to explain. Did he not know about them? Did he not want them? Was it someone else's fault?
One of the alleged gifts is the major renovation of Stevens' home in Girdwood. His lawyers say Mrs. Stevens was the one to oversee the project and pay the bills. Did we hear from her today?
Yes, Catherine Stevens took the stand and went through the bills she paid on their house in Girdwood. Many of them were to contractor Augie Payone, who runs a company called Christensen Builders. Catherine Stevens paid him around $100,000, which the government says certainly covers some of the renovation costs, but they claim that Vigo also did work for free. The government estimates Vigo maybe did $180,000 worth of work, and they say two Vigo employees in particular dedicated themselves to working on the project on Vigo's clock. Today, Catherine said she thought those men were working for Christensen Builders, who she paid. She knew they worked at Vigo, but she said for this project, she figured Christensen was paying them. She sent one of the men a thank you letter, a bonus check, and airline tickets. Those went to a guy named Rocky Williams, which she mailed to him at Vigo, not Christensen Builders. The prosecutors asked why, and she said, well, Williams must have told her to send it there. And she thought he was just like a seasonal Vigo worker. She also shipped Williams things to his address at Vigo for the house, like a cabinet and door fixtures. The prosecution poked some holes into Catherine Stevens' assertion that she thought Christensen Builders was the contractor covering everything. Like one example is the original renovation design plans. Catherine insisted that she paid for them in the Christensen bills, but those plans were actually done 2 months before she hired Christensen, and they were done by a Vigo employee who testified earlier in the trial to doing them on Vigo's time clock. Also, Catherine finished paying Christensen Builders in 2001, but a full year later, more work was done on the house. There was a new deck, metal stairs, a balcony. Catherine said she looked for a bill but didn't find one. Well, the prosecutor said, so you came home, found a deck, and looked for a bill, and then what? And Stephen said, you know, she didn't find a bill, so she didn't worry about it.
How did she explain gifts that Stevens is accused of lying about, such as the gas grill and a massage chair?
Well, her repeated statement was that she hated those things. You know, she said she never wanted the grill, didn't know how it got there, and she was actually afraid of using it. She said she hated furniture Bill Allen moved into her house. He took away her furniture and replaced it. But Catherine Stevens never moved his stuff out. It's still there at the house. And the prosecutor asked, well, you make a lot of money. Why can't you get the unwanted furniture out? And she said she didn't know where to send it. She was going to send it to the dump and just never dealt with it. Also, a massage chair that Stevens has at his Washington, D.C. home, Catherine Stevens said she thought it was stupid and was just taking up space. So she sort of deflected that and those gifts and said they weren't things that she wanted and they weren't things that she liked. They weren't things the couple enjoyed.
All right, Libby, thanks for that update.
Thanks so much, Lori.
That's Libby Casey, APRN's Washington, D.C. correspondent, reporting on the Stevens trial. A committee is out with a draft list of area infrastructure projects needed to handle the influx of heavy truck traffic gas pipeline construction would bring. The Fairbanks Metropolitan Area Transportation System, or FMATS, Committee of City, Borough, and State Representatives has identified 23 potential projects. Committee Coordinator Donna Gradino says they're aimed at facilitating the movement of freight through the area.
Those things that would separate heavy truck traffic from regular traffic, and also those type of projects that would focus in on those areas where pipe yards might be located and how to best move the heavy truck traffic out of those areas and onto the main national highway system like the Richardson and the Steese up the Dalton and down to the Alaska Highway.
Guardino says the committee list includes additional or revamped interchanges, pavement upgrades, a new or improved Richardson Highway way station, and reconfiguration of railroad crossings. The draft list was reviewed yesterday at a meeting of the FMATS committee, and Guardino says it will be refined as more information on construction plans becomes available.
The technical committee of FMATS is going to meet again and review the list and try to get some more information on possible corridors that the shippers will be taking and where the pipe yards will be located so that we can figure out truly where the greatest impacts will be and we can further prioritize the list.
Guardino says once the project list is finalized, the priority will shift to finding funding. The projects come in at about $200 million, a figure which could double with yet-to-be-estimated railroad project costs. She says the idea is to have work completed well before construction of a gas line begins. With presidential politics in high gear and the stock market in turmoil, about 100 people showed up recently at Juneau Centennial Hall to learn about a much more fundamental concern, survival. KTOO's John Ryan reports.
The Association of Government Accountants hosted the forum on survival in Southeast Alaska in the hope that some good might come of the disappearance of Brian and Brandon Andrews. The plane carrying the Deputy Revenue Commissioner and his son disappeared somewhere between Juneau and Admiralty Island 2 months ago. MC and government accountant Ruth Danner read a letter from Brian Andrews' wife, Joyce.
We cannot thank enough all those who contributed to the search and rescue efforts for Brian and Brandon and will be forever indebted to each and every one of you. And if this forum can bring awareness to anyone, potentially saving a life, it is a worthy effort.
Representatives of the state troopers, the Coast Guard, and seven other organizations spoke on search and rescue efforts. They also gave tips on maximizing your chances of survival if something does go wrong in the outdoors. Much of the discussion revolved around ways technology can help you. Bill Clutton is a flight operations commander with Alaska Army Air National Guard. He says in addition to two Black Hawk helicopters in town, the Guard has night vision goggles.
So you can be out there in the pitch black, have nothing more than a cigarette, and we'll find you. I mean, it looks like somebody's shining a flashlight at us.
Tips included filing a trip plan, never traveling alone, and carrying, at a minimum, your cell phone with you. But since cell phone coverage is spotty around Juneau, the survival experts say it's better to carry a VHF radio or a GPS-enabled emergency locator. The latest generation of the locator devices are about the size of a pack of cigarettes. And since not all search and rescue crews have night vision goggles, Bill Clutton recommends carrying a rolled-up reflective vest with you. Without it, rescuers could have a hard time finding you, especially if you're decked out in camouflage for hunting season. The forum also featured some low-tech approaches to survival. Victoria Johnson taught Zonda-Kahini Middle School's first survival skills class last week with the help of her fiancé, John Smith. She teaches in the school's Indian Studies program. Her survival class focused on traditional techniques, using your surroundings to help you survive.
We showed them how a spruce tree can be a shelter for staying dry. All the needles and bark and so forth that's underneath the tree is all dry, so they can use this for kindling if they needed.
They showed the DZ students how to use spruce roots and moss and branches to turn an old root wad into an emergency shelter in just 15 minutes. Smith says knowing how to use spruce sap might also save your life.
You get a wad of that 2-inch by 2-inch ball and light that up, it's going to be like a torch, guaranteed. I've had it to where I've had the size of my fist and dumped wet wood on top of it and still got a fire going.
In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
The state is updating its transportation plan for Southeast Alaska. That's the document listing priorities for new roads, ferries, and other major projects. The current plan was completed about 4 years ago and contains projects that are no longer being pursued. That includes additional fast ferries connecting the south and central parts of the region. It also includes new roads that are delayed or are on hold, including those out of Sitka, Juneau, and along the Bradfield Canal. Transportation Department planner Andy Hughes says funding is not available for the large number of mega projects in the previous plan, and he says it lists few priorities beyond the road north from Juneau.
After that, it kind of left it wide open as to, well, where do we go from there? And in effect, we've been pursuing a number of large projects simultaneously, without really recognizing that the resources required to implement all of these projects just wouldn't be realized.
Transportation officials are moving on several large projects. They're designing a ship that could serve marine highway routes in northern and southern southeast, and they're planning a road linking Cake and Petersburg, but full funding has not been secured. Hughes says revising the Southeast Alaska Transportation Plan will include public review, but it will be different than the previous effort.
We will rely more on the use of the department's website, email address lists, the U.S. mail, and less on public meetings to allow more frequent, widespread communication at lower cost.
He says the high price of travel plus budget constraints prohibit duplicating the extensive series of meetings held in 2004. More information will soon be available on the State Transportation Department's website.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo. You can learn the money skills needed for life with hands-on banking, an interactive program for students and adults from Wells Fargo, online at handsonbanking.org. And by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
Local authorities in Sandpoint have launched a citywide search for a Trident diver who disappeared Tuesday night. KSDP's Tony Gorman reports.
Local volunteers hit the back trails Thursday afternoon in hopes of finding 32-year-old John Shannon. Co-workers say Shannon was with them doing tests on the docks at the Trident Cannery between 7:20 and 7:30 Tuesday night when he told a supervisor that he was taking a bathroom break. He didn't return later that night. Some reports say he was seen walking into Sandpoint from the plant. Co-workers began looking for him around 7 o'clock Wednesday morning when they noticed he didn't return to his room. Crews consisted of mostly Trident workers spent all day and night searching for Shannon but had no luck. Shannon was working for Washington State-based EnviroTech and under contract to do repairs and tests on the docks for the rest of the month. He has been a harvest diver in Kodiak for the past 10 years. It's unclear if he's a Kodiak resident because records show he's had a Portland, Oregon address since 2005. Shannon also has a child and a long-term girlfriend. His parents are scheduled to arrive in Sandpoint later this week. Shannon is described as a 6 feet, 1 inch tall white male and weighs 210 pounds. He has dark hair and a goatee. He was wearing dark clothing at the time of his disappearance. In Sandpoint, I'm Tony Gorman.
The murders and seemingly random violence committed by a Fairbanks man in Grand Junction, Colorado, has shaken that community. Local police spokeswoman Kate Porras says the killing last weekend of two Grand Junction residents by Stephen Martin Urban of Fairbanks was a shock for the small Colorado city.
A quiet area with a low crime rate. And so this kind of tragedy is really, it shakes up a community like this. And it's something that obviously we take very seriously. And now we hope that we can figure out why this crime happened.
Police in Colorado are turning up few leads as they try to figure out why the 2005 graduate of Fairbanks Lathrop High School shot four people, killing two, and then killed himself last Saturday. Porras says police believe Martin Urban traveled 240 miles to Grand Junction from a relative's home in Lakewood, Colorado, where he had been staying in recent weeks. Martin Urban had no criminal history, and Porras says investigators are considering all avenues as they try to piece together what motivated him to turn violent.
That includes any connections he may have had, family, friends, looking at his online activities. And we're also, you know, then looking at the victims of this case and looking at all of their connections to their family, friends, and as well.
Porras says so far no connections have been made between the shooter and his victims, including the 61-year-old man and 6-year-old woman he killed. Martin Urban shot them outside one of the victims' homes where two couples were meeting to go on vacation. She says testimony from a surviving victim indicates Martin Urban may have followed one of the couples to the crime scene.
They may have seen his car in the area near their house minutes before the shooting and may have possibly even followed them to the house where the shooting took place, which was several miles away.
Porras says Martin Urban is believed to have been unemployed since he moved to Colorado. His Lakewood relative reported him missing last Friday. Horst says Martin Urban purchased the 9mm handgun used in the killings in Lakewood on October 2nd. The Alaska Marine Highway System plans to start sailing the fast ferry Fairweather into Angoon by the end of the decade, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Fairweather sails within sight of Angoon as it passes Admiralty Island on its route connecting Juneau and Sitka. But it can't stop because it doesn't fit Angoon's ferry dock. Marine Highway General Manager John Falvey says he has the $7.2 million needed to modify the terminal, and he's told design staff it's his top priority.
What we're doing now is we are commencing the environmental and the right-of-way and the design work, which will move us towards a contract award. And we would hope that potentially we could have the Angoon terminal able to accommodate both the Lakani, which it can now, and a fast vehicle ferry by the winter of 2010.
That's when the Lakani will be sidelined several months for major repairs. The small ferry is the only Southeast ship able to dock at the terminal. Marine Highway Operations Manager Chuck Van Kirk says the schedule is being discussed. He says not all sailings will dock in Angoon.
What we're looking at is, and we haven't completely explored it, but we're looking at the fast ferry stopping at Angoon on the way to Sitka and possibly on the way back on the next trip through. So we would be giving them directional travel that way.
The Lakati used to sail 24 hours a day, connecting Juneau, Hoonah, Tenneke, Angoon, and Sitka, but it changed to daytime-only sailings and dropped the Sitka connection. Angoon leader Maxine Thompson says her community needs to reconnect to a culturally sensitive funeral home and healthcare services in Sitka.
Right now we have elders, and if their health isn't such that they have to travel to Juneau, it just lengthens getting to the medical attention they need. So having a Fairweather come to Angoon is really important. Because of being put on a day boat status, that link to Sitka has been cut off.
State officials are also pursuing plans for an Angoon airport, but that's expected to take far longer and much more money than the ferry terminal modifications. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Prince Rupert.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. To send us your thoughts, go to APRN.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and click on the Contact Us link. Be sure to let us know if we can use your comments on the air, and if so, how to pronounce your name. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld and John Ryan in Juneau, and Tony Gorman in Sandpoint. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Profit is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Railroad Corporation, with daily rail service to Seward, Whittier, Anchorage, Talkeetna, Denali Park, and Fairbanks through mid-September. Information available at alaskarailroad.com. And by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at aprn.org.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.